Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
Good evening. I'm Marcia Langton, and I'm very honoured and privileged to be facilitating this session of the Melbourne Writers Festival with three of our great poets, Ali Cobby-Eckerman, Samuel Watson, and Claire Coleman. I want to first of all acknowledge the traditional owners of Naarm. I live and work on Naarm in the country of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung speaking people, and I owe a great deal to them for their hospitality and generosity, and I want to pay my respect to their elders, past and present. I also want to acknowledge all of the countries, wherever you are, where you join us from this evening. And on behalf of us all, acknowledge those traditional owners and their elders. So the Melbourne Writers Festival has titled this session Lines of Inquiry. But I want to begin by just making one very important acknowledgement, and other people may wish to as well. I could not have organised the First Nations sessions without the assistance of the First Nations Australia Writers Network, chaired by that wonderful poet Yvette Holt, and her crew, particularly Karen Wilde, who is a novelist in her own right as well, and you would have seen her in one of our sessions. So I want to thank Yvette for her great assistance in putting me in touch with the poets. Yvette and I talk about poetry, and we had a plan in mind, which was not to be because of Melbourne Writers Festival rules, but I'm going to stick to a little bit of the plan, and I want to acknowledge our much earlier poets, all of those who've passed away, the long tradition of poetry in our cultures, but those that I met when I was young, such as Jack Davis, Ujuru Noonuckle, and Lisa Belair. At the University of Melbourne, we've named a building after Lisa in honour of her work at the University of Melbourne, her great contribution to Victorian and Australian society. And it's on Royal Parade, so if you ever get the chance to drive down Royal Parade, you'll see a very tall white building called Lisa Belair, a wonderful poet and photographer, originally from up in northern New South Wales, sort of in Bundjalung country, and a wonderful Indigenous thinker, poet and artist. So I want to now just read out some short details about our guests this evening. First of all, we have Yunkinjajara Aboriginal poet Ali Cobby-Eckerman. She's the author of seven books, including the verse novel Ruby Moonlight, published by Mugabala Books in 2014, and the poetry collections Inside My Mother, Girimondo Publishing, 2015, and the memoir Too Afraid to Cry, Ulura Press, 2013. In 2017, she was awarded Yale University's Wyndham Campbell Prize in Poetry. Samuel Watson is an award-winning Indigenous poet and professional raconteur. He was born in Brisbane or Meanjin in 1972. He is of Mununjali, Birriggubba, German and Irish descent. His first collection of poems won the 1999 David Unipon Award. His fourth collection, Smoke Encrypted Whispers, won the 2005 New South Wales Premier's Award for the Book of the Year and the Kenneth Slessor Poetry Prize. In 2018, Sam was the recipient of the Patrick White Literary Award for his significant contribution to Australian literature. Claire Coleman, or Claire G. Coleman, is a Noongar woman whose family have belonged to the south coast of Western Australia since long before history started. She writes fiction, essays, poetry and art criticism while either living in Naarm here in Melbourne or now over in South Australia or on the road. She was born in Wadjuk Noongar Budjar country in Perth, away from her ancestral country. She's lived most of her life in Victoria, and she won a Black and White Indigenous Writing Fellowship for the novel Terra Nullius, published by Hachette Australia, and in North America by Small Beer Press. Claire's second novel, The Old Lie, was written in response to what she learned when travelling and was published in 2019 by Hachette Australia. So let me not take up any more precious time and hand over to Ali.
My name's Ali Kobi-Ekerman. I'm a Yankunjara poet. I'm reading tonight on Ngadjeri country. I'd like to pay respects to the Ngadjeri people, elders past, present and emerging. I'm also a board member of FNAWN, First Nations Australian Writers Network, and pay my respects to writers past, present and emerging and our ongoing contribution to Australian literature. I want to start reading with a poem called Thunder Raining Poison. It was a response to a beautiful art piece by Yoni Scarce, a Gugatha sister. A whisper arrives. 2,000 or more. Did you hear it? That bomb. The torture of red sand turning green. The anguish of earth turned to glass. Did you hear it? 2,000 or more. Yams cremated inside the earth. Poison trapped in glass like a museum. Did you hear it? 2,000 or more tears we cried for our land, for the fear you gave us, for the sickness and the dying. 2,000 years of memory here, 2,000 or more. Peaceful place, this place, until you come with your bombs. You stole our happiness with your poison ways. You stole our stories, 2,000 or more. Our people gone missing. Did you hear it? Where's my grandfather? You seen him? Where's my daughter? You seen her? Mummy, you seen my mum? Dad? 2,000 or more times I asked for truth. Do you know where they are? 2,000 or more trees, dead with arms to the sky. All the birds missing, no bird song here, just stillness, like a funeral, 2,000 or more. A whisper arrives. Did you hear it? It sounds like glass, our hearts breaking. But we are stronger than that. We always rise, us mob. We are not glass, we are people. 2,000 or more, 2,000, our spirits come together. We make a heart. Did you see it? In the fragments. It's there in the glass. 2,000 or more. Our hearts grow as we mourn for our land. It's part of us. We love it, poisoned and all. My next poem is the title poem from my collection, Inside My Mother. It's the last love poem that I wrote for my mother. My mother screams as I touch her hair, attempting to brush away the coarseness with my hands, to entwine twigs filled with leaves into her locks, a tiara of green to soften her face. And our tears dry now, my mother is frailing. She talks only to those who have gone before, no longer seeing my love, no longer needing. And the wailing bursts from her mouths as she sinks to the ground, her mother, the earth, my mother, the dying. Throws sand in her face, tasting the grit in her mouth, and wailing louder, throws herself forward, pushing her breasts into the softness of the earth, her mother. And my mother, the dying, crawls down into that final embrace, her conversation incoherent now, as if like a child she is practicing words for the lifetime to come. And the syllables loud and guttural spill over the sand, her mother, the earth. And I walk away leaving her there in that cradle, safely nestled in the roots of that tree, safe in our country. Our solace, her grave. I'll finish with this poem, and I would like to dedicate it to all who have died in custody. And I read this tonight with utmost respect and solidarity to the Yamatji community. Acknowledge our country. Acknowledge who we are. Acknowledge our love. Acknowledge your wrongs. That night was like driving into a death in custody. My teenage grandson whispering on his phone, "Nana, they're outside. I can hear them walking around checking the doors." And me whispering, "Sweetie, don't move the curtains even a bit. The cops are trained to watch for that. And stay very quiet. Don't move around too much. Wait till they're gone. And one might stay behind. They know all the tricks. And just pack a few things. I'm on my way." He rang 15 times, and just as I got to the outskirts of town, the phone went dead. I parked down the street from his house, slowly checking for cop cars hiding in the dark, before quietly tapping on the windows, but nothing. So I drive to his mum's to find out he isn't there. So we ring the cop shop. Yes, they'd got him and locked him up in the hospital under the Mental Health Act, and we can't see him because he's sedated. So we go there in the morning. He's tied to the bed crying and bruised and scared. His favourite hoodie is ripped to bits, and the nurses say we have no rights, and neither does he, because he said he wants to kill himself. His mum and I buy fish and chips to cheer him up. We sit around the hospital bed trying to tell jokes. The nurses hover around talking about netball. And I ask, "How do we get him out?" And they say only the psychiatrist can sign off. And I ask, "Well, when is he coming to see my grandson?" And no one knows the answer until they transfer him to another hospital. And his mum and I drive behind the ambulance. And this ward is nicer. He's not tied to the bed and can come outside for a cigarette. And we talk about why he says he wants to kill himself. And he says, "Doesn't everyone say that?" When the psychiatrist arrives the next day, we meet in a private room. A woman sits in the corner taking notes. And my grandson explains that when he says he wants to kill himself, it's just a way of saying how he feels. But he doesn't want to die. And the psychiatrist, who comes from a culture outside Australia and is old enough to know the value of kin, listens for over an hour before leaning over and signing my grandson to me. And we walk out to the corridor to the surprise of the staff, who are happy for him. And we buy fish and chips to cheer us up, then drive home for a rest, because this shit happens all the time.
Palia. Palia Ali. So I invite the audience to ask questions of Ali about her poems that she's read tonight and her poetry. Please put your questions into the chat. Sam, I'm handing over to you now.
Thank you very much. The piece I've chosen to read is called Monster. Be careful when you fight the monsters, lest you become one. Friedrich Nietzsche. I can't speak my grandmother's tongue. I've never been my grandfather's land. I've traveled here, I've traveled there. My culture is fabricated in government-funded laboratories. I'm Frankenstein of the Dreamtime. I'm Frankenstein of the Dreamtime. Reanimated flesh that once sung natural song lines surgically removed my Christian soul, repaired it with indigenous design. I'm a patriot to a black, yellow, and red flag, yet I consider myself colorblind. I am Frankenstein of the dream time. I am a mutation of the white Australia policy. I am Frankenstein of the dream time. I'm in the princess's nightmares. I am a self-educated Aborigine. I am the Prime Minister's worst nightmare. I am Frankenstein of the dream time. I scare some white people with my English and some black people too. I am Frankenstein of the dream time. Today people will sing Advance Australia Fair, and like the abomination that I am, I can only ask Advance Australia Where, because thinking black is a thought crime. I have no need for clean or discredited country. Only Australian nationalism can define my renegade nature of Indigenous context. I am Frankenstein of the Dreamtime. I was born into a family of song people. Ink courses my veins. I am Frankenstein of the Dreamtime. I'm a song man, not by lifestyle choice. I am one of Tony Abbott's monsters hiding under his bed. I think like this version of a monster, therefore I am Frankenstein of the Dreamtime. So thank you. I think I showed the vintage of that poem by mentioning Mr. Abbott, but it was a real pleasure to share that poem with the audience and to be reading on the lands of all the listeners. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam. Excellent. Thank you. Again, I'll remind the audience, put your questions into the chat and I'll come to you after we hear from Claire.
Hi, I'm going to read two poems tonight. The first is called I Am the Road. It was highly commended in the 2018 Uju Ninokul Poetry Prize, published in Overland Online. I Am the Road. My grandfather was the bush, the coast, salmon gums hakias, blue-grey banksians, wind-whipped water, tea-black estuaries, sun and grey stone. My grandfather was born on country, was buried on country. His bones are country. I am the road. I was born off country in that city. I hear, less than 2 weeks old, I travel country in a bassinet on the back seat of a Kingswood. I remember travels more than I remember home. I am the road. My father is the beach, the peppermint tree, the city back when, before it was a city. My father is the ancient tall tree country between his father country and that town. My father is World War II. His father was a soldier. My father wandered, worked on rail, drove trucks. I am the road. Campgrounds up and down the coast were the childhood home of my heart, where my memories fled, where my happiness lived. Campgrounds in somebody else's stolen country. I am the road. The road unrolls before me. My rusty old tree wipes oily sweat from its underside on the asphalt, says, I am here. I am here. The engine breathes in, breathes out, pants faster than I can, sings a wailing, thundering song, wraps its steel self around me and keeps me safe, a too large overcoat. I am the road. We showed explorers where the water was. They lay the road over our path from water to water. Lay a highway over their road, tamed my country with their highway. I am the road. My budger has been stolen, raped. They dug it up, took some of it away. They killed our Boron, killed our Yonga, our Waich, Dama, Quokka, put in wheat and sheep. No country for sheep, my Budja. My country, most of it is empty. The white fellas have no use for it, except to keep it from us. Because we want it back, need it back. Because they can, I am the road. People ask where I am from. I cannot simply answer. To mob, I am Noongar. South coast, I am Banksias. Wind on waves on stone. To travellers, white fellow nomads, I am from where I live. That caravan over there. To white fellows from Melbourne who see how I drink my coffee, I must be from Melbourne. I am not Melbourne. I am the road. One day, wish to, hope to, dream by some of my grandfather's country back. Pay the thieves for stolen goods. Theft is a crime. Receiving stolen goods is a crime. Until one day, I am the road. And the second poem I'm going to do is called Strawberry Juice, which I slipped into an essay in my new book, which Marcia probably hasn't heard of yet because it was only a few weeks old, called Lies, Damn Lies, and that which came out like a few weeks ago. And this poem is called Strawberry Juice. My page is spotted with strawberry juice. They were plump, pink, crisp, surprisingly juicy. The juice stains anemic on the page, fading pale like my family's skin. No solid stainer blood these. To blood stains they'll be weak, soft, faint, vanilla. When they dry, they will dry brown. I'm not no use to writing on paper. I forgot how it stains, how indelible marks on paper are, so unlike a screen. No matter what sticks to a screen, you can just wipe it off. I'd forgotten how, if you rub paper, even the cleanest hands leave a mark. They kept records, the whites, in ink on paper all those years ago, long before computers existed. The paper was fragile as the lives whose endings they recorded. The paper was fragile, the words were not. Screens are hard, glass cold, breakable but not terrible, durable in their glassy way. Splash them, drip strawberry juice on them, and there's a chance of salvation, a chance to not harm if you wipe it off. Blood stains do not stay on the screen. Imagine if, when they killed, when they got permission to kill, it was by email. Easy to delete. They did it on paper. They killed on paper before they did it with guns, horses, poison. The paper is still there. Too precious to discard. That is why we know what they did. Our lives, our deaths were recorded on paper, and on paper they soaked in like strawberry juice soaks in. You cannot remove it and leave your precious paper intact, clean, white paper. On black paper it will just soak in, like institutional trauma, like generational trauma, and disappear. No stain would show. Yet the stain is still there. You can write on black paper, but you cannot read it. My page is stained with strawberry juice, and I like strawberries, simultaneously sweet and tart. My page is stained with scrolls of ink, my scrolls, black ink. I have tattooed the paper. Notice how the black of the ink covers over the white paper. Notice how the white page is empty. Notice how paper covers rock, covers my country, my people, are one. Notice how easily paper tears. I'm eating all the strawberries. I have no guilt. I like strawberries, although they are white fella fruit, although they're grown on stolen land. You like strawberries. White fella, him likes strawberries, even when they're grown on stolen land. I'm certain they were grown on stolen land, the death, the blood, you'd think it would make the fruit bitter. Sweet fruit from bitter soil. Sweet fruit from bitter soil. Tart fruit from bitter soil. Thank you.
Thank you, Claire. Well, that was quite overwhelming. I'm not sure how the audience feels, but we've had a a feast of poetry from three of the best. So thank you very much to each of you. Now, there are no questions from the audience as yet. Don't be shy. Put your question into the chat. I'll start off then. So I sought you out for this session, even though, you know, poetry is not my thing. But I am fascinated by people like you who are so accomplished in finding exactly the right words and putting them together in a form, an unusual form, and acting like, and being, actually being spiritual and emotional guides to an inner world. And what you do for me is provide me with a much bigger emotional toolkit, more of a spiritual toolkit, so that I can think calmly about the horrors that you write about and the depth of emotion that you feel about them. So, Ali, you did, I think, in your first poem, I think that you're talking about the atomic testing in South Australia, is that right? On Yunkinjarra land, on Bijinjarra land.
Yeah, on Gugatha country. The atomic testing had a big effect on my family, and the poison in that land still has an effect on family. It's a story that I don't think most Australians know properly, that the British were given permission to test atomic bombs on country that wasn't cleared of Aboriginal people. They say it was. We know, like Claire said, the paperwork shows that experiments were done on our people. And when Yoni Scarce made that beautiful, huge glasswork of 2,000 yams and it was hung at Tanandi Festival, we were asked to respond and I chose that. And, it was a difficult and a spiritual response. And I think that's what I love about poetry, because when you push yourself, sometimes the words come together and they're a gift. They're a cathartic gift to myself as a writer, but also they're a gift to Australia to learn more of our story, because, we know the Australian story. But I doubt that most Australians know our story.
So true. So do you find it difficult to use the words from the English language to express these very profound feelings and emotions?
Well, it's a sort of like a necessary curse. And I'm a survivor of, the stolen generations policies. So I write in English. But I spent a lot of time in the desert even before I found my family, and so I believe I can think Yunkinjarra, but I write in English. I think that's just another gift that was forced upon me, and also as that educational tool, writing in English reaches a wider audience. Yeah, a lot of my poetry has been cathartic. I only found my mother when I was 34. And up until then I knew a lot of stories, but I didn't know the stories that impacted my family. I think I was lucky in some way, in a ridiculous way, to become a poet later in life, because the pressure and the emotions that I encountered, I don't think I would have coped so well at an earlier age. I had a bit of maturity. And, the importance of my writing has always been to write the truth and for justice and also for my cathartic healing.
And I think for the healing of others, I felt waves of emotion as you read that poem about Yoni Scarce's 2,000 yams. It's very powerful, but it's very healing. It somehow words have an impact, not just for you, the writer, but, you know, for me in the audience. I feel as if, you know, here is something of a resolution. There can be no resolution to this horrible event, but you have found the words to express the legacy of those atomic tests.
Yeah, and, you know, it's really important and it's an, you know, it's an honour and a cultural obligation if younger people or even our older people gain some healing from hearing or reading my poetry, because often, you know, there's so much healing to be done and sometimes we're exhausted by our healing. So if we've been given this gift, it really is a cultural obligation.
Thank you. You really do have a gift. Sam, so tell us about your monster. I mean, I think we all understand the implication that you're driving at in your monster poem, you know, the racial hybrid that, you know, so horrified Australians that they had the White Australia policy, they had the stolen generations, they removed children from their families, they labelled us according to the colour of our skin. But I could be wrong. I mean, I really want to hear what you are implying with your monster. Is it your resistance or does your existence, you say that your existence frightens people?
At times I have felt that. I premiered the poem in Medellin, in Colombia, in front of 6,000 screaming Latin Americans, and next week walking through Medellin, absolute strangers were, oh, monsturo, monsturo. They really understood some of the things that I was getting at in the poetry. I suppose growing up in Bajoki Pearson, Queensland, we were always reminded as school kids that there was something monstrous and unclean about our background. We weren't exactly Australian as the rest of the kids in the school ground. It does teach you to be a little monster, you know. You are that way to survive. So I'm not sure if I'm articulating myself the best I can, but I mean, metaphor is such a wonderful weapon to fire back at our critics. The metaphor that both Ali and Claire, you know, I mean, it's just opened my eyes to language that I've thought I've used and I thought I've heard about, but no, it's been a very educational session for me tonight. Thank you.
Oh, I think you've more than adequately told us. And it's very unfair to ask of poets and artists, so what did you mean by this? So what does that mean? It's very unfair. And I know that artists use metaphors and can never fully explain what they mean because, you know, behind the concept of the monster, this idea of the monster as you've shaped it in your poem, there's elaborate world of your childhood in Bjelke Petersen's Queensland. I like that you said that your monster is under Tony Abbott's bed. I like that your monster, you know, is creeping into there consciousness and creating some horror for them.
Yes, thank you.
Is that a kind of revenge?
I strongly believe, I think anyone that's spent time with the Murray family, we were up here at Murray's, goes out there, Curry's, Nas, we don't mean to curse, but we look for a possible reckoning one day. We watch many of our elders perish without seeing the resolve of something that's deeply affected their lives. And I believe that a lot of mainstream Australia expect us to just speak under our beds, but under those beds are the monsters that that kind of contempt breeds. So, yeah.
I like that you use the word reckoning. And, yeah, that's right. I think it's a given that, you know, with the monstrosities that were inflicted on our people, and, of course, the frontier is so much closer to us in Queensland because, you know, it was in my grandfather's generation, it was in your grandparents' generation, very close. We see the evidence of that vicious frontier everywhere. And reckoning, yes, because, you know, there's no escaping from it. So, of course, we must respond. There must be a reckoning. And I think Australians should count themselves fortunate that this reckoning is in the form of powerful words that make us think. In other parts of the world, these reckonings are so much more violent like the violence that was committed on our people. So thank you. I thought I was going to get something else when I asked you for a poem, but I am truly gobsmacked by that, and I thank you very much. So, Claire, are your strawberries a metaphor for blood?
My strawberries are a metaphor for blood, and they're actually just strawberries, because things in poetry can be two things at once. I wrote that poem. It's one of the few times I've actually been to a writing workshop, and the workshop descended into literally just a few of us sitting around writing in the same room. And I was indeed eating all the strawberries, and I bit into a strawberry and it splattered my page as I was writing and looked a lot like blood. And, yeah, so strawberries are a metaphor for blood, and a metaphor for, because of their paler colour, they're kind of a metaphor for the weak blood that the colonisers thought we had. Was one of the common recurring phrases, the idea of our blood being weak and that we are due for extinction. And as always, I was cognizant in my writing that the best weapon we have to defend ourselves in the ongoing race wars in Australia that has never quite ended is actually the white fella's own weapon that they use against us, which is their words. So our strongest weapon is their weapon. And if we can learn to use it as well as they can, then, or better than they can, then perhaps we can win. So, yeah, I like metaphors that are both a metaphor and not. So, yes, the strawberries are blood and literally strawberries.
Yeah. So, but there's nothing ambiguous about that. So you're now an award-winning accomplished writer with novels, and, yes, you're right, I didn't know about your latest book, and you've written essays. So you wrote a pretty powerful book, I think, Terra Nullius, yeah, the first one?
Yep.
Was that your first? Yeah.
It was, yeah.
So how did you, what brought you to the discipline of poetry?
Well, it's actually interesting because as an artist, poetry was my first discipline. I've always had a deep and kind of unstoppable love of poetry, and I think I write good poetry, but I've never had as much luck at getting poetry published as I would like to have. But so I like to think that my poetry and my desire for the poetic turn of phrase escapes into my other work, escapes into my novels, into my essays, and it kind of adds to the power of the words that I'm trying to release. But poetry's always been there, and I never stopped writing poetry. I've heard before saying that people say many times that poetry is the best exercise that writers can have. If we write, not all poetry is going to be good, but the act of writing poetry makes us better at any other type of writing we want to do. So I continue to write poetry, and it always will. But it's funny because my first desire was to get a poetry book published, and I ended up getting a novel published first. And I know people whose first desire was to publish a novel and have had poetry published first. So We can choose what we like to write. We can't always choose what other people are going to like of our work.
Very interesting. I did not know that about you, because I think Terra Nullius is a bit on the sci-fi side, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Yeah. Look, I'm just going to read out. We have some audience questions and comments now in the chat. I'm just going to read them all out at once. So jump in when I read them all out and, you know, pick the one that you want to answer and go for it. This is from Jean Taylor. Would each of the writers give us an idea of their writing practices, where they write and what prompts them to write? Great session, by the way, loving the poetry. Anonymous attendee, fabulous name. Hi all, I chose to study your poem a little bit long time in my literature class this year. Having spent time analysing this poem, I would love nothing more than to hear the story behind this piece and what influenced this poem. It moved me to tears. Sorry, not a question. This is from Ian or Eni. Sorry, not a question, just appreciation. Thank you all for sharing your gifts. We need this. Anonymous attendee, thank you for the beautiful poetry. I feel grateful, honoured that you have all shared your stories with us. Does writing poetry energise or exhaust you? And from Jan McKenzie, Frankenstein was a monster made by the master. He only wanted understanding. From a Ngamaji, white person, Wurundjeri, I really got that poem. Thank you. So who was it who wrote Little Bit Long Time?
Yeah, that's the title poem of my first collection. And that was I was out at a desert community, and an old lady was sharing a story of her life. She was the little girl in that poem. And she was telling me, you know, so she watched the murder of her father, and it was quite harrowing to listen to her, a quite frail older woman. But she wanted to share that story and remind me the importance of forgiveness, and that she'd had a good life because she'd been able to forgive. You know, there's just so many massacres and murder stories everywhere when we sit down around the campfire. We're never far removed from that. And I've travelled across Australia and visited many communities and sat down with many different elders, which prompted the verse novel Ruby Moonlight, which is a massacre verse novel, but focusing on the survival after massacre, because we have survived. And we're always forgiving. And even in forgiveness, we still have to hold the anger that drives us for justice every day, every week. Media is so broad now that, you know, there's no rest from all the horrific stories affecting, you know, all realities affecting our people. And I think my writing process, I haven't published for a while now because I needed a rest, and I needed to find a way to go a little bit deeper. I needed time to investigate myself. So I'm very organic. I might be driving to work and have to pull over on the side of the road, or more often I have a recorder in the car and I record while I'm driving. Those thoughts that become writings can arrive at any time, and the discipline is needed to get that onto the page and get that to a manuscript, and then continue to have conversations with publishers. But there's no race, or there's no rush for me. It will happen when it happens.
Thank you, Ali. So, Sam, does poetry energise or exhaust you? Where do you write? What are your writing practices?
Well, at the moment, I'm confined to a wheelchair due to an accident. Ali there talks about the discipline. There is quite a discipline that I follow. Poetry doesn't tire me, but I'm very much inspired by hearing words that I've wanted to use and hearing them used by another wordsmith, hearing them tackle a subject or a project to tackle and how they've gotten over the line. I suppose every day is an experiment, I suppose, my own laboratory of words that I keep sort of poking a stick at, seeing what will bite me back, you know?
I like that.
It just was like the one question, I suppose, I had for Claire was the second poem that she read. Well, has anyone ever approached you, Claire, about putting music to your work? There were some very repetitive lines in that poem, but it was quite beautifully lyrical. So have you ever thought of mixing your work with another medium like music?
I've thought about it. It's funny, my writing, if there's any single thing that inspires my writing more than anything else, it's music. I don't know if anyone else does this, but I'm the sort of person, if I'm at my desk writing, I've got music on. And I think that changes the rhythm of my writing quite a bit. I like having a rhythmical style anyway, but I listen to music. And it's funny because the style of what I'm writing is often affected by the style, the genre of music I'm listening to. So I'll carefully curate what I'm going to listen to for what I'm writing to change the mood. Sometimes I listen to trad jazz to try and get that feel into what I'm writing. And other times it's desert reggae. So it changes a lot. And I have thought about putting it to music and I think about that a lot and maybe one day it'll happen. So everything happens if it's meant to happen. So hopefully it will happen.
So I think our session is going to be cut off quite sharply at 7:30. And I want to just quickly get in a big thank you to the three of you. I want to thank our Auslan interpreter, Amber, and I think Steve is there as well. Thank you so much for your hard work. I want to thank Fionn again. And I do want to thank my colleagues at the University of Melbourne, at the Indigenous Knowledge Institute and the Indigenous Studies Program in the School of Culture and Communication who supported me to step in and rescue our First Nations sessions when our Melbourne Writers Festival was cancelled because of the pandemic restrictions. It broke my heart to think that we couldn't come to these sessions, so I put my hand up with the other curator, the other First Nations curator, to make sure that all of you got a chance to give us an insight to your work. It's been an enormously proud moment for me. And in closing, I'll just read from Ali's review of Lisa Blair's book of poetry, Aboriginal Country. Breathe deeply for tomorrow. Inhale to the Mother Earth's soul. So again, thanks so much to all of you.
And happy birthday.
Thank you.
Happy Melbourne Writers Festival, everyone. Listen hard, read more.
Yeah, I miss Melbourne Writers Festival. Please, everyone down there, take care. Very special people.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.